Hi, we're up to part 11, The Kuzari and the Christian. Now, recall that we had mentioned before that the Kuzari, this book, is primarily not a polemic against Christianity and Islam. Its primary goal is not to defend Judaism against the attacks or arguments that are lodged by Christian and Islamic thinkers. Because if it were, Rabbi Yehuda Halevi would have devoted far more space to fairly flesh out the theological arguments of Christianity and Islam. The reality is he only devotes about a page to each of these out of this very large book. And we pointed out that indeed these two religions are not the main challenge to Judaism during Rabbi Yehuda Halevi's lifetime. That is, that Jews are not flocking to convert to Christianity and Islam, certainly not voluntarily, based upon the theological attractions of these two religions. However, he does feel he needs to address these two religions in some way if he's going to show the inherent superiority of the claims made in the Jewish Bible, but he does so in a very cursory fashion. And I think that when we notice how he's going to contrast the miracles that are contained within the Torah versus the miracles that are contained within the Christian New Testament and the Islamic Quran, we'll be able to see that he really only brings in a very cursory discussion of these two faiths in order to accentuate and highlight the virtues of the miraculous accounts that are contained within the Torah. And so therefore, if we see Rabbi Yehuda Halevi easily refuting these two faiths and dismissing them after only a few words of argumentation, it's because he's being docha bekash. He's actually just dismissing in a very light fashion these two imaginary clerics, not because they are the real formidable enemies, but rather because he's only using them as a prop to get to his major event, which is to defend Judaism against its real detractors, that is Greek philosophy, and later on in the book, it's Karaism. So we're now at a point on page 58 in the Feldheim Kuzari, subparagraph 3, where the narrative states that afterwards the Kuzari said to himself, after he's dismissed the philosopher, "Let me ask Edom, the Christians, and Yishmael, who are the Muslims. Surely one of them must have desirable actions. There is no point, however, in seeking out Judaism. The fact that the Jews are so small in number and universally despised proves that they must be wrong." And notice that Rabbi Yehuda Halevi here is underscoring the lowly stature of the Jewish people. And indeed, the name of the Kuzari in its fullest text is the Kuzari in defense of the despised faith. Clearly, there was a perception that truth lies with the masses. And if the Jewish population is such a small portion of the world, then clearly they must not possess the truth. Later on, I think it's worthwhile for us to analyze that if Judaism is so inherently and so obviously true from a theological and a logical perspective, why is it that it never really caught on to attract more adherents? And that's something that is also taken up by Rabbi Yehuda Halevi. Now, we should observe before we go any further that many editions of the Kuzari have this entire section of the argument of the Christian and the counter-argument of the Khazar king completely censored out. Obviously, we know that many, many Jewish books that contain any kind of negative attribution to Christianity have been censored over the centuries by Christian clerics looking over the shoulder of our Jewish publications. So, without going into the actual text, we'll just summarize it. The Christian cleric, the priest, begins his argument by acknowledging that everything contained in what he calls the Old Testament in the Jewish Bible is accurate. He acknowledges the story of creation, the story of the flood, the stories involving the patriarchs Avram, Yitzchak, and Yaakov, the Exodus and all of its miracles. And he also emphasizes, and this is where I'm quoting from paragraph 6, he states, this priest, that there can be no doubt as to their veracity, as to the truth of these stories in the Jewish Bible, because the miracles recorded therein were shown to all nations of the world. The miracles endured for extended periods, and revelations were made apparent to the masses and not just to individuals. And we want to point out here that Rabbi Yehuda Halevi is really foreshadowing at this point how he's going to demonstrate a very important distinction between Judaism and the claims of Judaism and the claims of Christianity and Islam. At that point, the priest goes into a discussion of the virgin birth, which is a very foreign-sounding concept to someone who was not raised in a Christian theological milieu, how it's possible for a virgin to become impregnated by God himself, and then the child that she gives birth to is none other than the Son of God, who is in reality God himself. This is the Trinitarian doctrine, which is very, very difficult to understand. Centuries have been devoted, and reams of paper and much ink have been spent on trying to explain what this doctrine actually is. Then, after the priest explains his belief in the Trinity and the virgin birth, he then explains the principle of what's called supersessionism. That is how, although originally the Jews were the chosen people, their chosenness was taken away from them and transferred to the disciples of Jesus when the Jewish people betrayed their Messiah and had him crucified. Nevertheless, he says, those Jews who did follow Jesus act as the yeast for the rest of the body of the Christian people, who were predominantly Roman pagans. And then that is how the nation of Christians, or the Christian faith, began, and how it took off and became a world power. Then the priest explains very concisely some other doctrines of Christianity, and that those are that, number one, we have the mandate to go and proselytize, that is to turn the rest of the world into good Christians by accepting Jesus as their personal Messiah. We have to accept the Messiah. That's part of the definition of what it means to be a Christian. And we also elevate the icon of Jesus's execution, which is the crucifix. The priest then points out that we follow the teachings and commandments of Simon the Apostle. Now, Simon the Apostle, it may be hard for us to figure out who that is because we're not experts in Christian studies, but it's really a reference to Simon Peter. The Apostle Peter, that is how he's more famously known, his name was originally Simon or Shimon. He became later known as Peter because Petros in Greek is a rock, and this man Simon isolated himself in a rock basilica towards the end of his life, and therefore he became known as Peter. He was the first bishop, the first pope, and therefore the priest says he's the one that we follow. And then finally he finishes with a paraphrasing from the book of Matthew. This is a very famous attribution to Jesus where he states, I have not come to negate any of the commandments given to the children of Israel and their prophet Moses. I have rather come to add strength and fortitude to them. Now, I just want to add a couple of things to this narrative that we are presented about Christianity. First of all, I think it's quite interesting and telling that Rabbi Yehuda Halevi singles out the Apostle Simon Peter and doesn't single out the more famous, perhaps, apostle, the one that had more influence on proselytizing the world to Christianity, who was the Apostle Paul. One of the theological divides in early Christianity was whether to follow Paul or Peter in some kind of struggle that they were having about how to define what early Christianity was. Peter believed that it was absolutely necessary for even a disciple of Jesus to continue following and performing the mitzvahs that are contained in the Jewish Bible. And therefore, one would argue that Peter, if one were to see him today on the street, would look like a very frum Jew. Paul, on the other hand, was the apostle who felt that it was no longer necessary to follow the commandments. There's a doctrine known as antinomianism, which states that once Jesus was put on the cross, his absolute ultimate sacrifice absolves all future Christians, that is, those who accept him as their personal Messiah, absolves them of the observance of the commandments. This, too, of course, is a very foreign concept to Jewish ears, but nevertheless, it is a very important doctrine of Christianity, and one which Rabbi Yehuda Halevi seems to completely ignore in his depiction and presentation of Christianity. It would seem to me that as we go through the Kuzari, and as we've already detailed, for Rabbi Yehuda Halevi, the mitzvahs themselves are absolutely vital. Human performance of physical acts is really what defines religion. And therefore, it's almost like a non-starter to even suggest, when we talk about Christianity, that we would even think about following the Apostle Paul and his teachings. Because for that, Rabbi Yehuda Halevi doesn't even have to get started in even describing Christianity, because that's a religion that is just as deficient as the philosopher who preceded the priest, in that don't tell me that you're not bound by specific actions or behaviors, because I've already dismissed that in my arguments against the philosopher. Rather, what Rabbi Yehuda Halevi is doing is saying, even if I will grant you that you as a Christian have the right to subscribe to the Apostle Simon Peter, who feels that you are still bound by the commandments of the Torah, I still find Christianity lacking based upon certain theological holes that exist within Christian doctrine, even if you are going to fulfill the commandments. So what does the Khazar King find objectionable? And he writes on page 61 in paragraph 5 that really, to a person who has not grown up with Christian doctrine, these ideas that you're presenting to me are totally illogical. And anytime you want to convince someone of something that runs contrary to logic, you need to provide demonstrable evidence. You need to provide proof. And in the case of the Old Testament miracles and the miracles that are contained within the Torah, we will see that there is a preponderance of evidence to corroborate the accounts of the miracles. But as far as the virgin birth, something which runs completely contrary to logic, there is simply no corroborating evidence that Jesus was the Messiah, that he was the Son of God, that his mother was a virgin when she conceived, and the absence of this evidence is a deal breaker for Rabbi Yehuda Halevi. I want us to recall that Rabbi Yehuda Halevi maintains this principle that it is the visceral experiences of this world that provide the individual with the greatest level of surety and knowledge. That is, I know more by experiencing something than I do by simply intellecting something or hearing it and cognizing something. A lot of times my intellect can be deceptive, but if I see it, if I feel it, if I can touch it, then it's real. This will play a very important part as we go further in Rabbi Yehuda Halevi's theology. If I haven't seen it, if I haven't felt it, if I haven't experienced it, I have no way of knowing whether it's true or not. And this is where Christianity becomes incredible for Rabbi Yehuda Halevi. If no one has seen the miracles that you purport have taken place, then you can't convince me that it's ever taken place, especially because what you're describing is, to me, completely illogical. So how indeed do the accounts of the Torah differ? How is it that the miracles, like the splitting of the Red Sea, are different from the miracle of the virgin birth? That's something that we'll see soon. And as I mentioned before, this is why I feel the argument, this back and forth between the Khuzari and the Christian is so important. Not so much in order to be able to deflect Christianity, but at least to highlight where Judaism and Christianity differ and to demonstrate how the accounts within the Torah are so far superior than the accounts that are contained within what the Christians call the New Testament. And we will continue.